Welcome to another round of Lankavatara Sutra, investigation of mind only. All of our experience being mental projections, not really out there, external to mind in the way that things usually appear to be. So while we're still fresh at the beginning of the evening, let's just try for fun a kind of guided meditation, a Lankavatara meditation. So make yourself comfortable if you're not already. Because I think that this meditating on mind only, we need to be very comfortable and relaxed. To settle the mind into its nature, to release our grasping involvement with a seemingly external world is a lot about just relaxing body and mind. So sitting still and relaxed, we notice the sensory experiences of the present. Any kind of meditation, we can start to notice our actual experience in the present. We have 5 or 6 senses, so we just start to notice the sound. There's this voice coming in. There may be some whistling and cars in the background also. And so starting with sound, let's say, noticing it as sound, but it sounds like I'm over here, apart from your mind. But just to let the sound come into the ears and start to open to these teachings that we've been hearing about a little bit, how the sound experience is actually happening in the mind. It's very convincing to think that the sound is coming from over here. But just to kind of creatively and imaginatively imagine the sound as actually created in by your mind based on various causes and conditions. The actual experience, your direct experience of the sound, is not somewhere over here on this side of the room. And likewise, with your eyes open some, you're seeing colors and shapes. Just to start opening to how the mind is actually creating the experience of a visual experience. Of course, at first we think that the colors and shapes we're seeing are out there, external to mind, but just to open to the possibility that the mind is creating them. We're not talking about mind as something inside our head or something like that. No particular location inside or especially outside. The colors are not out there. It's almost like we're withdrawing the sounds and colors closer to us. We're not reaching the mind out to touch sounds and colors, but we're almost retracting the colors and sounds. Provisionally, we could say inward, but it's not really into some internal location. But since we're so outward directed, we could just say drawing them inward. And bodily sensations, too. We think that the contact we feel of our bottom on a cushion or a seat is down there. This particular location at the bottom of our body. But again, to open to how the mind is creating that illusion that the contact is down there. The experience of contact is down on the, where the cushion meets the bottom. So particularly these three senses, colors and sounds and physical sensations, letting them settle down into unlocatable present experience, not external to mind. And in a relaxed but concentrated way, you might even feel that such a meditation is quite relaxing, that it takes some energy and creates some tension and a little bit of disturbance to relate to a color or a sound or a physical sensation that's out there. That sense of externality is a little bit draining, so we might feel a little refreshed and relaxed and energized to let these objects, these sense objects, settle. And then there's a sixth sense, mental consciousness, that's coming up with all kinds of ideas about these very experiences and other completely unrelated experiences. Was that car out there on the street? Or is the experience we're having of it completely a mind experience? We can't really say that the car is out there on the street, except from our long-standing habitual ways of relating to car sounds. So seeing how our mental conceptual ideas are also not about anything out there. It's just mind, unlocatable mind. All of these experiences of color, sound, physical contact, and conceptual thinking are like waves. waves stirring around in the ocean, the vast ocean of storehouse consciousness. So this meditation is also like letting the waves settle into the ocean. Vast, calm ocean, letting the waves of external appearances settle. No longer reaching out from our side to contact objects. Just becoming the ocean. And if you do this over time, you may notice that the still ocean is ungraspable in terms of location and appearance, but it's there's some brightness. Attending more and more not to the waves but to the ocean from which they emerge and settle back down. And in the Zen tradition, we could call such meditation turning the light around and shining back. The light of awareness that's reaching out to external objects, backing it up, reversing the light, tracing back the radiance of awareness of externalities back to the source of mind, the still bright ocean. It could also be called thinking of what doesn't think, attending to this vast ocean that's not itself doing any thinking or constructing of externalities. We could also call it just wholeheartedly sitting, not caught up in construction and involvement of external appearances, but dropping off all our projected ideas of body and mind. Coming to rest in this unknowing ocean. you for your attention. It's such a meditation. That wasn't very much time to really go deeply into that, and didn't give you so much silent time to really explore it more subtly. But do you have some sense of that, or any comments on such a meditation practice, and how that could be a mind-only or Lakavatara version of Zazen? Yes.
When you said to disassociate from the sound, that there's a car out there, this thought flashed up, but if I go out and see a car...
Yeah, that's like in such a meditation, that's just, we call that the sixth consciousness, constructing a conceptual idea of like, so instead of doing that in a way, this kind of meditation is very, very simple. It's not involving like becoming convinced of any philosophical points about this. I would say when just doing the meditation, just hearing the sound of the car and in our experience, noticing how the experience of the car is not out there. Where in this case, I think not even so important to wonder, well, is the car really out there? That's just kind of like a distraction from the meditation. But our experience, I think sometimes this mind-only tradition is like the experience school of Buddhism. Direct experience. So, does that make sense? Like when doing the meditation, we'll get into all these points, of course, when we start discussing these things in class, of is there a car out there or not. But in terms of meditating, to notice how our experience of it is not happening out there. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. That's a little different than saying, is the car out there or not? It's saying, our experience of the car is not out there. And that may be totally obvious. Well, of course, the experience is not out there. But that's a major point, experientially. Because we actually hear the car, and we don't even think that it's our own experience. We just think, there's a car out there. It's like a fact. It's like, it has nothing to do with my experience. There's a car out there. But actually, it is just our experience. And that our experience, in that case, built on sound and conceptual consciousness. These cars out there are a great example of how we do this, because we hear that sound and we have an image of a car, maybe not a particular kind, brand of car, but we picture a big thing on four wheels rolling along out there. Almost like they call generic image. Conceptual images are, in Sanskrit, samanya lakshana. They're just purely conceptual, generic images of a car, as opposed to sva lakshana, which would be like when you see the color and shape of a car. And the sixth consciousness can do both. It can mentally have a direct experience of the, based on the sensory experience of color and shape, it can know directly. But much more commonly, we're used to the sixth consciousness seeing like generic images. Yes?
Yeah, I think the meditation for me points out that it's really of no use to wonder what the nature of the noisemaker is. Apart from my prior experience, my alaya, if you will, imputing something to the noise, this becomes really clear if one's ever been near somebody with PTSD, combat PTSD. That same sound, that same event might have somebody on the ground. That thing out there was a very different reality for the person who is wondering if there's something going to explode, as opposed to somebody who just sits in the park on Sundays. So different experiences entirely. And the majority of the issue is not the noisemaker at all. So you can say, what is the reality? The PTSD person, that person is scared to death, almost literally.
And somebody, maybe like the president of Toyota, might wonder if that car's a Toyota.
It might not be a car at all. It could be a flatbed truck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so what it is, actually, I think I could say there is something ungraspable out there that is interacting with my mind in a way that produces this part recollection, part novel experience that says that. But except for the fact that we all have similar brains, we're all really experiencing something entirely different.
Yeah, and because we have different karmic patterns.
Yeah.
And so in meditation, most forms of meditation, we're like putting aside as much as possible those all those karmic tendencies and just experiencing directly. But I would like to point out that, I don't know if anyone noticed this, but that this particular guided meditation is different from another kind of meditation that we sometimes might hear about that's just attending to sounds and colors and so on. You see how it's a little different? I'd say it's based on such a meditation. Say we're just sitting. Some people might talk about just sitting like this, that we're sitting and we're aware of a sound, and it's a sound, and then we're aware of a color and aware of a sensation, and we might even be like not picking any particular object, but we might call it like choiceless awareness of just different objects, different mental objects or sensory objects we're just being aware of. And I think for this mind-only meditation, that would be the starting point. But then it goes another step, right? It's not just attending to the objects, it's noticing this particular thing of how we're adding this little bit. It might not be very much. If we're really settled into zazen, we might not be projecting the car out there so much, and there's less and less conceptual idea of the car, there's more and more just sound, but still, doesn't it seem like it's out there apart from the mind? So this mind-only meditation is not just attending to the objects, but it's kind of withdrawing them in, right? It's just a way of talking about it. It's more and more coming to see how our experience of them is not outside the mind. So and I would propose that kind of meditation is even more settling and relaxing than just attending to the objects, attending to sensory objects.
I was wondering the other day, I was talking to a colleague, and she said that she once actually took a little course or seminar on meditation, and they told her, and I heard that often before, that meditation is basically about trying to think nothing.
Mm.
And that actually scared her off because it sounds so hard.
Mm-hmm.
And it also seems really, I don't know, I don't want to use the strong word wrong to me, but it seems like not a good start.
Well, I think it's impossible.
Yeah.
So. And maybe not totally impossible.
Yeah. Something like that.
But almost impossible.
Is a better idea.
And it doesn't mean that there's no thinking at all in this kind of meditation. It is approaching more and more a settled place of not much, not the usual stream of obsessive conceptual thinking. We're letting that settle more and more, but anything that we're noticing that comes up, whether it's a sensory object or a mental object, which is just another kind of object, a mental object would be like a thought, conceptual thought, whatever it is, we just, if we notice that it's how it's projected, imagined or imputed to be out there, we just let, like a wave rising from the surface of this non-external alaya vijnana, storehouse consciousness, letting that wave settle back is like, then the conceptual thought, we could say, settles back into this non-conceptual storehouse. But then another one comes up. There's no end to experiences, and we don't need to end them. But the more we don't reach out in both gross ways of like, wonder what kind of car it is, and like, my car is kind of like got some problems, and all the stories that go from that, you know. We might say, just car, that's a start, but then this is another step from that, even of like, or even just sound out on the street. It's withdrawing it more and more internally. And again, internally doesn't, it's not like Alaya is like inside our skull or something like this. It has no location, but it's not, it's just one mind, one experience that has no inside or outside. So this is, choiceless awareness is like attending to a bunch of different objects, and it's maybe somewhat valuable practice, but this is more like approaching non-duality. Which you could say is a kind of like a little joke or a kind of contradiction in terms, because you can't really approach non-duality because then it's a thing that you're approaching. But in terms of, as we're talking about it, as a, you know, we're approaching the direct experience of non-duality, we're talking about is the non-duality of the perceiving subject and that perceived object. We're like shrinking that gap. This is turning the light of awareness back to the source, letting the waves settle back into the ocean until the there's no subject-object separation. Though there still might be, you know, like sound waves and color waves coming and going, but like it's less, like it's more and more like we don't know what's going on, which is a little bit might be a little scary at first to I think part of it is difficult and maybe frightening to just let go of this separating tendency of mind, because we're so used to it. It's like we disappear, you know, as a self in relation to the world. It's kind of like we're shrinking that whole gap, and it's like, wait a second, it's a car, okay? I'm here. Because the self doesn't want to, like, give up its role of being a self. But it's kind of like temporarily, as a meditation, just relaxing that whole set up, relaxing this imagined self and world and just being, I don't know. Yes?
I think color was a little easier, especially kind of if your eyes are sort of out of focus and you kind of generally have a sort of who knows what color is coming. And it seems more closer than something that's out there. It's more like just color.
It seems closer, but maybe if you were looking out the window at the mountains of Monterey,
it might then seem further
than the car, right?
Yeah, no, I agree.
I think these are just
something about sort of being surrounded by a color. And same with, you know, meditation, where you just kind of, your eyes are sort of out of focus, and at a certain point it's just light. In fact, I don't even see at a certain point a lot of times meditation where.
Yeah.
I mean, I know there's this field of dark and light, but I'm not really seeing it anymore, which is kind of interesting.
I think that's true. When you let your vision blur, it seems less like external colors.
But I think in Vipassana, at a certain level, some people get into sort of the sense doors and kind of paying attention to the door itself. So kind of noticing sort of this connection of stimulus with the door. The doors are the stimulus.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that can be, I don't know if that's part of the four foundations of mindfulness, because there's a lot of kind of mindfulness-related things that are keyed into that. And there's, you know, kind of different stages of those four foundations of mindfulness.
It strikes me when you say that about, which I think that's it, any meditation that's bringing us into our direct experience of the present is very helpful. And maybe if the meditation is meditating on the sense doors themselves, like at the eye organ, for example, maybe a mind-only extension of that would be like doing that very practice, but then seeing how, oh, actually, my experience of the color, though, is not really happening here. Something's happening here, but...
the door is not just the eye.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because its mind is actually... we need the consciousness and a mental consciousness to know that we're having the experience. So our knowledge of the color and our sense of that the color is out there in relation to me somehow, that's not even... That goes beyond the location of the eye organ to this unlocatable mind.
In listening to an audio book by Dawkins, the greatest show on earth about evolution, and he has this really long chapter on the eye, how the cones are there and it's signaling to the brain, and actually everything is upside down, and then there's this huge blind spot that they're making up for by scanning and remembering what's there, and that we have most fantastic Photoshop going for us continuously without knowing it.
Yep, yeah. But yeah, we talked about that last week some. Yeah, about the upside down image and how the mind, I mean, scientists would say the brain is constructing this Photoshop image of reality. From a Buddhist perspective, we say it's more like the mind. And the mind has some relationship to the brain as a physical organ. And it's kind of interesting in modern times now to start mapping mind. I think it was it Isho Fujita yesterday was talking about these senses some, and he said, now when you're seeing something, like, imagine the part of your brain that sees up in this certain quadrant, because he'd studied like different parts of the brain in science. And I wondered about that in terms of like the mind-only thing. I'm like, well, maybe we can actually feel some, if we're really sensitive, we could feel some little electric energy when seeing in a certain part and different parts of the brain. But the kind of classic Buddhist view would be like, though that maybe, it doesn't deny that that's happening in the conventional brain. It's saying the actual experience is not in the brain. Our actual experience is not in the brain, but experience is mind. And mind, though maybe closely related to brain, has no location. And and also, just a little note here, without going too much into it, because we'll save this for a future time, but... This type of meditation exercise and offering is might sound like, well, we're just, isn't it, is then the end result you're just like settling and resting in alaya, the storehouse consciousness? Well, is that the whole story of such a meditation? And is that the path to complete awakening? And so, you know, we say that the storehouse is also the storehouse of delusion, and it's going to have to be like overturned or transformed at some time. So we maybe would say that's not really the whole story. But the unique thing about this Lankavatara Sutra is it says that the storehouse, Alaya Vijnana, is like another name for Tathagata Garbha, or the storehouse of the Buddha or Buddha nature. So it's kind of unique to this sutra. But if we see it like that, then this, you know, withdrawing the external appearances into a more non-dual experience of just what is, we could say that we're like settling back into storehouse consciousness, or we're settling back into Buddha nature, this completely undistorted, undefiled, non-dual Buddha awareness infused with unhindered, non-dual compassion and so on. So if we put it like that, then we could maybe say that is the whole practice and realization, that path, that type of meditation. Let's just turn to the sutra a little bit, so we keep making our way through this. This is on page 1 of this handout at the very bottom. In the book, it's section 8, page 73. The Buddha says, "Who sees, or whoever sees, that the habit energy of projections of the beginningless past," we'll stop there for a minute, just unpack some of these terms. This is where it's packing in a lot of Yogacara mind-only concepts here. Habit energy is this term vasana, Red Pine's translation of vasana, that it could also be translated as like karmic tendencies, predispositions, latencies, habits, tendencies, impressions, influences, permeations, or perfuming, as even said, or like the scent or perfume or traces left from an experience. Those might sound like a lot of different ideas, but it's this, it's like the karmic effects, traces, subtle imprint of a karmic action, which is just a intentional action of body, speech, and mind, infuses, would be another word, the storehouse consciousness. So, the habit energy of projections, or vikalpa, of the imagining an external world, arises due to karmic tendencies and habit energy of doing that very easily, right? Here's our world. We have a strong habit to see this as an external world. And that vasana is like permeates the storehouse consciousness. It kind of sinks into it. It settles down, rests into, and perfumes, scents, kind of flavors alaya in this little way. We have this other common mind-only term called seeds. Like that experience plants a seed or a bija. And they're virtually equivalent. They're two different kind of metaphorical images for how an experience gets registered in the storehouse. One is to say it plants a seed. They're just metaphorical images. There's not really a seed. But another, just if you wanted to play with another image, and just in case you're fixated on seeds, it's kind of nice that they offer this other one of like perfuming, which is less of like a physical little thing, right? It's more like infusing the storehouse with this latent tendency. Means like it leaves an impression that now forms a kind of latent karmic pattern. Like we get angry at someone, say, and then that experience forms this latent tendency in the storehouse. It's latent means like then like a few minutes later we're not angry again, but now there's this latent tendency for anger to arise again in the future. That's one way of looking at it. How this storehouse is storing these karmic tendencies in a way That's mostly what it is, what Alaya, the storehouse, is. It's like a storehouse of all these karmic tendencies, but also non-karmic things, like direct sensory experiences. It's also storing those things. But most, I don't know about most, but a lot of what's there in Alaya is all these karmic patterns that define unique individuals. This is why we have so-called different storehouses, because we have different karmic patterns due to our previous actions and karmic tendencies. Yes?
Current day cognitive science would simply say that what you know, you're more likely to experience.
Yeah.
That you render a new stimulus in light of learned experience more probably. And this is important when we obsess, because we're creating artificial experience which reinforces the delusion.
Yeah.
And that is a way that Alaya actually becomes a storehouse. And in one sense, you could say that Buddha nature is all things are equally possible. There's nothing there that says this is going to be more a probable interpretation or refutation than that. Hmm. So the practice would be actually to question the first thing that comes to mind and say maybe not, maybe not.
Not always so.
Not always so. And that would tend to raise bumps to the point where we raise up bumps until everything's even again. Maybe get approached.
Yeah, another example of that tendency, and a really simple thing, is like we hear that sound and we all pretty much immediately, without having to think about it hardly at all, could say that it's a car. But someone from, you know, who doesn't have karmic latencies for car sounds, who's just lived in the rainforest their whole life, has never heard a car, they'd have no idea.
You might think it's a bird or something.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's this important term, habit energy, is Red Pine's translation for vasana. It appears throughout the sutra. And projections, we talked about last time, is this vikalpa, or related to parikalpa, or imaginations, projections, imputations that are forming these habit energies or vasana. So one who sees that the habit energy of projections of the beginningless past, or from the beginningless past, because this has started way back, is the cause of the three realms. The three realms is like the entire, we talked about last time also, the whole world of samsara, the whole dualistic constructed world, the universe of experience. So already, that's a huge, like, overall big statement about summarizing Yogacara in one line, right? One who sees that the habit energy of projections from the beginningless past is the cause of the three realms that creates the illusion of the world, right? That's a summary of the whole sutra right there. And also, who understands that the Tathagata stage, we could say, like, when one realizes complete Buddhahood, is free from projections or anything else that arises. A Buddha no longer imagines the three realms. One who understands that attains the personal realization of Buddha knowledge, which Red Pine points out is one of these two main threads of the sutra. He says, realizing that everything is projections of one's own mind is one thread. And then he says, in his introduction to the sutra, he says, this svapradyatma arya jnana, personal realization of Buddha knowledge, is the other thread. And Red Pine's take is like, that's what makes this particularly, why Zen people in the early days were attracted to this sutra, because it's about this personal direct experience, which Zen is very much about. So one realizes this personal realization of Buddha knowledge and effortless mastery over their own minds, meaning like they're not like me controlling my mind now. That's just another illusion, but the effortless mastery over how one creates projections and believes in projections or not would be like the mastery of mind. So that's a nice kind of like summary of the whole sutra, that sentence talking about how delusions created, a summary of the creation of delusion, and then a summary of Buddha free from projections. And like gems capable of reflecting every color, they enter the subtlest thoughts of other beings. So this is kind of neat. I picture this as like the Buddhas we're talking about now, right? The Tathagata stage. Buddhas are like these gems capable of reflecting every color. Buddhas just become these clear crystals that, like a mirror, they just reflect everything else. A Buddha is not projecting their own stuff, but they can reflect a bunch of other, projections of sentient beings. So they can meet sentient beings like a mirror, and then thereby they enter the subtlest thoughts of other beings. So this might be like when we're doing this meditation and we're settling into this experience of no subject object separation, it's like we could say Buddha is like these Buddhas are now like coming into our mind. That might sound weird, right? But the Buddhas are not external. At this point of realizing Buddhahood, they're not like some being like floating in the sky out there. They have no location anymore. They've ended all projections of location. They're everywhere. And yet, they can like enter into subtle thoughts of other beings. Maybe we could say, as our Buddha nature. Yeah.
It's good that there's this, I mean, Tathagata stage is basically the same as just
Buddhahood.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering, it's probably going to reveal how little I actually understand. But a Buddha or somewhere at Tathagata stage basically is a complete human, of course. He or she did not lose ego. Everything is still there, every component, but the attachment is gone. He or she can, for example, the ego, the senses, whatever, use as tools. And
well,
like one level behind everything.
Mm.
More objective.
Well, in the Mahayana, in the great vehicle story from ancient India, and most of all these Mahayana sutras would agree on this, that Buddha is like a pretty amazing thing. That there's these like it's complete realization of Buddhahood. There's these 10 Bodhisattva stages, which is why they call it Tathagata stage, and these great Bodhisattvas are, I would say, a little bit more like what you're talking about. They're still appearing as humans. They are humans in a way. They are humans, bodhisattvas. They're sentient beings, but they're on the path to Buddhahood, and at various levels of progression, they're projecting less and less, but they're still able to project a world and interact with beings who are really caught up in their projections in order to help them. That's bodhisattvas. Now, according to the classical Mahayana story about Buddhas, they're usually said to be, they're no longer sentient beings. They're actually, you said, of course they're humans, but the Mahayana story, scriptural story is, they're not really humans anymore. A Buddha, but the Buddha has three bodies. And this sutra has a version of three Buddha bodies that are a little different than the regular three that we know. And one's like the vast Dharmakaya, the reality body itself. And then one is this transformation body, a Buddha, that appears. So the story here in the Mahayana, Shakyamuni Buddha, who lived at a certain time and place in India and appeared to people, was like a transformation body. from the reality body, but not exactly like a human, but to many people, he appeared as a human. And I mean, this might sound like a weird story, and Theravada Buddhism doesn't have such a cosmic story. But that's the story. And then, you know, so we have sentient beings and Buddhas. And in Zen, then, because it's built on this Mahayana story, there's a lot of... Zen starts to really play with this relationship between Buddhas and sentient beings, which is a kind of dualistic separation in the Mahayana teachings. But since Zen is really pointing towards cutting through dualities, a special thing in Zen that you don't find in the sutras is the non-duality of Buddhas and sentient beings, or the non-separation of Buddhas and sentient beings. And Dogen brings up this kind of thing. But since we're in a, you know, the sutra version, that's what, how it's being presented here, is like at this Tathagata stage, is free from projections, meaning like even the very subtlest projections of colors and sounds. It's like they no longer have six senses. I mean, this might sound inconceivable to us, and it's supposed to, or it is. A Buddha is completely inconceivable. So that's the story we're going with in this suit, because it's a sutra. Is that hard to handle? But luckily in Zen, we break it down. We bring this vast, inconceivable, cosmic thing like right down to earth, and we say, we can't find any separation between a Buddha and a sentient being. In fact, Buddhas, you know, because Buddhas don't make separations. They don't get into the separation between Buddhas and sentient beings. So that's what this kind of thing is based on. That you maybe don't hear that. You might find it in some sutras. But
well, like you wouldn't have the ocean separate from the waves.
Yeah, yep. You wouldn't have the ocean separate from the waves. And any kind of separation. And yet Buddhas can respond to sentient beings. So that's why this thing of, this is the story I'm imagining here, is that this at the Tathagata stage here, we're not talking about like a flesh and blood person. We're talking about these three bodies of Buddha, and that they become like gems, right? That can reflect other colors, and they enter. If they had flesh and blood, they wouldn't be able to enter into the subtlest thoughts of other beings. And in their apparition bodies, so this is one of the three bodies in this sutra, in their apparition bodies, which is this term Nirmita Nirmana Buddha, which is a kind of a pretty much equivalent to the Nirmana Kaya that we are maybe more familiar with, which is like a transformation body of Buddha. They can manifest or transform, make a transformation manifestation body to teach beings nothing but mind, or mind only, citta matra. This may be one of the first places in our section here that term comes up. Citta matra, mind only, or Red Pine says nothing but mind. These Buddhas, they're invisible to our sensory world, but they can teach us mind only, while establishing sentient beings in the sequence of stages, in these bodhisattva stages. Therefore, Mahamati, you should devote yourself to the cultivation of personal attainment. So that's a heavy-duty little section there about the whole path to Buddhahood. It's a kind of summary. You might wonder, well, where do we go with that? But it's just a summary.
You say the cultivation of personal attainment, would a sangha would say that is aspiration.
That's part of it. There are many, many aspects of the cultivation.
There is no attainment, really. But there's aspiration to attain.
Well, that's the cultivation. You can't cultivate an attainment, right?
No.
But you can cultivate the aspiration. But then there could be an attainment.
Elevation of personal attainment would be the attainment of non-person.
Yeah. Or the Heart Sutra says, no attainment.
No,
so there's, you know, ultimately there's no attainment, but when we're speaking of stages and so on, we can talk about it.
So you could say that the Buddhas inspire aspiration.
Yeah, and that's exactly how Dogen talks about bodhicitta, and Dogen's two main Shobo Genzo fascicles on arousing the aspiration for awakening. He says this aspiration is born in the communion, the mystical communion of Buddhas and sentient beings, which is very much in accord with this story in the sutra here, that these Buddhas, they're not really like some spirit that comes from outside. They're unlocatable, but they're Buddhas, and they meet us, and they meet us as, like, in this version, very beautiful, I think, they meet us like these pure, clear, crystal gems in our subtlest thoughts that reflect this, that reflect our subtle thoughts, and they teach us mind only in our own thoughts.
Which is said to provide us experience.
Yeah. Could say that, something like that. So it's not just like we can do it on our own. We do it in this meeting with Buddhas, mystical communion, kano doko, is this interesting term that we talk about sometimes, where Buddhas, and we're not talking about somebody walking down the street and saying, hey, everything's mind only. I mean, it might happen like that. But it's, in this case, it's like in this very subtle way that they're actually entering our mind stream. And Buddha nature is very related to this. That's that they teach us through our Buddha nature, meeting our sentient being. So that's our little summary section. Now, we continue with section 9 on page 73. At that time, Mahamati Bodhisattva, great intelligence Bodhisattva, said, may the Bhagavan, the Blessed One, the Buddha, teach us about the characteristics of mind, citta, the will, or manas, and conceptual consciousness. Mano vijnana. This is it now, the eighth, seventh, and sixth consciousness. Teach us about this. Mind, the general definition for citta, it's another synonym for alaya. Alaya, storehouse consciousness, is also called mind, overall mind. And will is manas, or the mental sense faculty, intellect, mentation, and it's defiled by this sense of self. It's not mentioned that, that's not mentioned here. Will, he translates, because the Chinese character is, means something like will, or to reason, or reflect, or consider. Character E. And conceptual consciousness, or mental consciousness, the sixth consciousness. Please teach us about that. And then the five dharmas, which were mentioned on the first page, we'll get into some time later. And the modes of reality, the three natures, svabhava, cultivated by Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, that differ from the external realms perceived by our mind. So all these teach us these base, all these mind-only teachings, these classic Yogacara teachings that are different from the way we usually experience these external realms perceived by mind. And may the Tathagata reveal all the teachings marked by suchness that comprise the heart of the words of every Buddha. So he's asking for instruction here. Suchness, or non-duality, is the heart of the words of every Buddha. And may he explain for the great Bodhisattvas gathered here on Mount Malaya in the island kingdom of Lanka the ocean and waves of repository, storehouse, consciousness, and the realm of the Dharma body, the Dharmakaya, praised by all Tathagatas. So this is just asking for instruction here. And the Red Pine quotes a footnote here. I wish that he would, you know, since he looked into these Chinese commentaries, I wish that he had brought out more of them, and maybe he felt like they weren't that interesting or they didn't say that much. But here he, from one of the Chinese classic commentaries on the sutra, from Tai Shu, he says on this section, the Dharma body, the Dharmakaya of the Buddha, the reality body of Buddha, one of these three bodies, has no attributes, but also does not have no attributes. Because it has no attributes, it is the nature of suchness. Suchness is undivided non-duality itself. So obviously that can't have attributes like this as opposed to that, because that would be dualistic. But because it does not have no attributes, it is the waves of our repository consciousness. I appreciated that footnote. That the Dharmakaya is both non-dual, no attributes, but also, it's a double negative, which they do to just be careful. Be careful positing anything here, because we can grab onto it. So we just say, it's not that it has no attributes. It's a Buddhist way of being safe, safe from grasping something. Does not have no attributes, therefore it's the waves of the storehouse consciousness. So the Dharmakaya of suchness can also manifest as waves. This is kind of like Buddhas and sentient beings are not two, as Johnny just said. It's like the ocean and the waves are not two. That. The Bhagavan then told Mahamati, there are four causes that result in the functioning of visual consciousness. And what are the four? Before we get into these four, let's just look at Red Pine makes a footnote here about the usual four ways that are the causes for consciousness. Because this is like the Lankavatara Sutra of the four causes. So in the classical model here, we have like, so the sense faculty, gate, organ, power, and the object or field, and then the consciousness that mediates between them. So if we're talking about the eye consciousness, what are the four, you know, usually it said three, but just to make it match what I think Red Pine's saying here too, is that the eye consciousness arises dependent on the faculty and the object. And we could also say, did it say the experience, the consciousness, or the seeing, or the
lack of awareness that what is grasped is a perception?
Yeah, well, before we get into this, is he's going to list these four here.
Oh, I see.
The functioning of visual consciousness. What Red Pine's note says on this, that I wanted to point out here.
Oh, the power of sensation, the domain of sensation, the consciousness that arises from their conjunction, and the desire for sensation.
Yeah, so he's listing consciousness as one of the factors of consciousness. But let's say for a visual experience, we need four things. One, two, three. And then four, he's saying the desire, but another way we could put it is the contact. These three have to contact. And they dependently co-arise. The eye faculty, the color, and the eye consciousness. It's not like first you have at least in this system we're talking about, you don't have like colors out there waiting to be seen. It's like a color and an eye organ arise together with the eye consciousness. These three of these come together and they contact. Particularly like that when the eye contacts the color and visual consciousness is born at that moment. So that's my understanding of the four things that he's talking about in the kind of classical, usual Buddhist presentation. Is it like one, two, three, and the four is contact? He talks about it like the domain. What are his words?
The power of sensation, the domain.
So that's the power, sense power.
The domain of sensation.
And the domain, I would say, is the field or object.
And then the consciousness that arises from their conjunction.
Uh-huh.
And the desire for sensation.
Yeah, so that's a little funny.
Maybe,
but I think he's talking about the usual like pre-Yogacara version of a visual experience where maybe the desire is that the mind has to, there's an intention to look at a particular object. So it's like, you know, we're looking around. This is like really, really the basic root before there's any like, I'm going to decide to look at that now. It's like just that the eyes moving around and looking at different things. It like there's a little bit of intention going into every experience.
Reaching out.
Yeah, like a reaching out. Mm-hmm.
Kind of like when he was sitting there. And,
yeah.
You know, as opposed
kind
to
of automatic.
Just experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah, I think we could say that. I think that's what he means by desire mm-hmm. for particular. Color, you know, without, but pre-conscious, pre-conceptually conscious. Also, just while we're looking at this chart, we talked about this sometime before, I think, but these faculties, the sense organs here, are technically not really like the eyeball, right? We were talking about like the retina, but we're not even talking about like a physical retina. Maybe a nice way to talk about this, well, here's a sensitivity or receptivity to light. And the ear organ is not the little like eardrum or something, but it's a mind, a very, very subtle mind receptivity to sound. And same with nose, tongue, body. They're like a sensitivity or receptivity. It's a subtle mental faculty. And I was looking into a little bit about this notion of how it's saying that in other pre-Yogacara schools, they have this mind-matter problem. Like, how does mind contact matter? And I said, there's this thing called an akara. It's been sometimes translated as aspect. I think literally it's like, the term means like something like aspect. but it's the quality or characteristic of an object, like a color, that causes the sense consciousness to arise. So it's not like we're actually seeing like a physical like molecule of color. Even in this is pre-Yogacara, they have to deal with this issue, right? How can a visual consciousness see like a physical molecule of color? Like how do we make that bridge that gap of mental and physical. So they came up with this idea of an akara. That's like the this quality, or it's also could be called like the ability to be reflected in consciousness. So a color has this ability to be reflected in consciousness. It's not the sign. Sometimes we use this term nimitta or sign, because that's actually a subtly conceptual thing. This is a non-conceptual thing, and the sense faculty is just a pure receiver of this akara, pure non-conceptual reception, and then the consciousness is kind of an active quality. The creative part of an experience comes with the consciousness. That faculty just receives the color, but it receives it through this aspect. And there's different versions. It can get really complicated. There were lots of arguments in old India about, is there like one aspect of a, of like, say there's this piece of paper with black and red writing on it and a whole thing. Does this whole thing have one aspect that we immediately perceive visually before we read the writing and stuff, just a visual experience? Is that one, or is it a, like, is there a little different aspect of each spot of red line, each spot of black writing? So there were these different schools of thought. Like one was called the half-eggists, which is like two halves of a, like a hard-boiled egg split in half, and like they're matched. They match up exactly, that the consciousness has just one side of an egg that perceives this other side of an egg completely. The two halves matching exactly. That was one version. There's just one aspect, one akara, and the object offers up an akara, and the subject, there's also an aspect that they meet like two halves of a hard-boiled egg cut in half. That's one school, but the one that got mostly agreed on is that that there's a separate aspect, and I think I can see why they agree. It's just more accurate that there's a separate aspect for each like molecule. So one teacher talked about this as like it's like a pixelated world. It's like this thing is, you know, pixels, right? And digitized like a digital photo. You can choose how many pixels. You know, thousands and thousands of tiny dots of color, and they make up an image, that it's like that in this ancient version, that's like each of these offers up a separate little, like, platform to perceive, not just colors, but also, like, the shapes, like the square shape is another. We usually say color and shape are the two objects of mental perception. So there's a separate aspect for the shape and for the shape of each letter. So there's like billions of these akara there. And from the subjective side, from the visual consciousness side, there's also like thousands of aspects of consciousness. So we don't, we open our eyes and there it is, an immediate thing, actually, it's like billions of little experiences. And that kind of makes sense, I think, physically, too, that it's not just like one, if you say it's just one half of an egg or something, it's kind of like, gets kind of generic again.
Well, I just think of just reading anything for someone that knows how to read,
mm-hmm.
knows what the written language is.
Mm-hmm.
There's obviously all, every word, the letters build words, and then the words build sentences, and then the sentences build paragraphs, and then.
But here we're just talking about.
Build story, and, you know, so there's all these levels of, black and white stuff.
Yeah.
But it's this whole very.
Yeah, we build upon. But in this case, we're not. That's a conceptual thing, too. In order to make words and phrases and get meaning out of it, this is just purely direct. That's the amazing thing. This is before all that even kicks in. We're just talking about pure direct sensory perception of color and sound. It's built up of a pixelated. Before number six. Yeah, and they make this distinction. Number six can have a conceptual version and also a direct, there can be direct mental perception, but it's before that. Just sensor, the eye consciousness, meets the mediates between the aspect of an eye organ and the aspect here, Let me just finish the little bit about aspect, because we might not ever get into this again. We probably would never hear about this again. It's a very, like, obscure kind of topic, but related to this discussion. So there's these separate aspects of shape and color, and then you look over here, and then another color, and so on, and another shape, and then a sub-shape. You know, it's like a very complex visual image here, and they're perceived in different moments by different aspects of the sense consciousness. There's a subjective aspect and an objective aspect, like a pixelated world being perceived as one unity, one object. This is direct direct sensory valid cognition. And so for in these early schools, this akara, this aspect, performs the function of making the connection between mind and matter. That's the way that they explain it. And they also say it's like a, it's like an image or reflection of an object. This aspect is like a reflection of an object. And the actual outer object is hidden. So even in these early schools of Buddhism, they still say you can't directly perceive a color, a molecule of red. Even way before mind only came along, they said, you can only perceive this aspect. They said, they're not denying that there's red, that there's molecules of red. They just say we can never experience them. This is pre-mind only, but you can see where they, how they built on this, right? And they need to have this aspect. Let me just finish this story here, in order to perceive it. They say the way that they explained it was like the molecule kind of gives rise to this aspect, and then it ceases. Everything is in Buddhism is one moment, right? So it rises, it projects this kind of like image of itself, and then it ceases, and then we perceive the image like perceiving a glove instead of the hand in the glove. It's one image for that. Right, so we can't actually ever see the hand itself. We see this like this aspect. It's like shape relates to, and that it's like this layer over the thing. So I've mentioned this story as a pre-Yogacara story. It's just like, well, how does it do? How does the molecule project an aspect? That's a weird kind of magical story. How does it do that? So again, as Yogacara comes along and says, like, look, folks, we don't even have to deal with this issue if we say that those molecules, there's not this like hidden molecule out there. There isn't one. It's all mental projection. There's just a glove. There's no hand in it. It's created by mind, so it eliminates that problem. Yes.
I know we have been at this point before.
Yes.
I think the mind-only school actually denied the separation between matter and mind.
Yes. Yes.
So I can't believe in that.
Well, the way it denied.
I mean, you know, the all the things we talked about before, mm-hmm. to me seem actually very advanced, because what science actually did in recent decades is to confirm all of these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In a very plausible way.
Yeah. Yeah. So. So let me just say that as it's time to stop, one way to look at this is that it looks like if you start going into these texts of the sutras, and then the people who really got into elaborately commentating on this, like Asanga and Vasubandhu, are considered the founders of mind only. You can find texts where they don't necessarily say this, but you definitely find a lot of places where they really do try to make this point that there's like there aren't physical molecules out there. But that's not their main point. Their main point is liberation from suffering by grasping things as real. So some people, especially in modern times, and it's often modern Western Dharma teachers and scholars, say, we don't need to go that far for this system to work. And it's not even so much a matter of proving whether there's atoms hidden behind the sign. You know, in this case, they don't even have the akara, right? But whether there's something out there physically or not, they just say, just like the early schools of Buddhism say, if there is, we can never know it directly. So in our experience, it's just, again, it all comes down to our own experience. In our experience, everything is mind only. Everything is projected. Now, whether the imputation or imagination of this projected world is based on a hidden physical material world, it looks like, you know, according to this tradition, they're saying, you know, there's really, since we can't ever know it, why say that it's there? And we might say, well, there's good reasons to say that it's there. But modern people say, you don't even need to go there. It's just that where you do need to go is to see that everything we've ever experienced from beginning of this time has not been a material world. We've never experienced directly a material world. It's all like this layer. And that's very conducive to liberation. That's the whole point of this, lest we forget, right? Is that if we can't grasp, if this is not really out here this way I think it is, we really can't get a hold of it and know that this is just an illusory town and world, we're free, right? Because this is the ongoing homework assignment, right? Is to see every time suffering or discontent arises, see if it's based on a belief that there's something out there. I can pretty much guarantee it will be.
Just one more thing.
Yes.
I would think that because of some things I learned, I would think that, you know, there's some problems that I have, and I completely understand, you know, we don't even have to go that far. One thing that immediately popped up when studying biology, we did, for example, an experiment where you cut off the head of a fly and then you measure the electrical signals that come from the nerve, from the eye nerve, when you flash it with light. And you can actually see in the nerve the signals from the light, and they're, you know, the resolution is much higher. That's why flies can never be killed.
So even without the organ, just the nerve itself is receptive to light, you're saying?
Yeah, you can basically show, if you flash it with light, you can see each flash of light showing up on the screen, but perceived by the fly. So you know, what you were talking about earlier with all the pixels and single packages of information.
Yeah. It's in accord, So again, if you say we don't need to, and I don't want to spend too much time in this class debating whether or not there's a material world outside of our experience, because I don't think we can prove it either way. Because we, according to this, as we're hearing more of this, we can never know it or experience it, right?
Well,
so
physics is saying the same thing.
I think so, yeah. But anyway, that one place to go with it is now you have the story from the early tradition about the akara. If you kind of could follow that the physical material molecule projects like an image in order to be known. See how that's a problem too, right? No matter how you somehow we have to make. If we say there's a material world, we have a problem of how we're going to actually contact it. You have to make this like. You have to bridge that gap somewhere, and wherever you bridge the gap, whether it's the akara and the coming out of the molecule, like a glove over a hand, or whether it's some other version, it's like, how are you going to bridge that gap?
There's just more and more layers of stuff you have to create.
Yeah.
Every step.
So it's, that's the sweet simplicity of mind only. It's just you don't have to bridge a gap. So, in a way, although you can't be too lazy because it's pretty complicated. May all beings realize that everything they've ever known is mere projections, and thereby be freed from attachment and suffering based on the belief in the reality of such projections, and live for the benefit of all beings. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.